Good morning. It's 7 a.m. and 89 near 98. And it will be mostly clear today, but we have a heat index value as high as 104 degrees. A heat advisory remains in effect until 8 p.m. in the evening. Today is Wednesday, June 30th, 2021, and you're tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial free speech radio, WBAI New York. Conversation with retired teacher Matthew Golden. Matthew has spent more than 40 years serving New York City's families as a history teacher, assistant principal, and dean of students. He's a veteran of the progressive educational movements coming out of New York City. He was the director of New York's Restorative Justice Pilot Schools Initiative, the initial effort at formally establishing restorative justice practices in New York City's schools. He's currently a consultant for the Department of Education and lead trainer and coach in restorative justice practices. Stay tuned. And we had some technical difficulties, but here's your update on the COVID-19 pandemic. On Monday, June 28th, scientists reported that the vaccines made by Pfizer and Moderna, both mRNA vaccines, set off a persistent immune reaction in the body that may protect against the coronavirus for years. The findings in their study add to growing evidence that most people immunized with the any boosters, so long as the virus and its variants do not evolve much beyond their is not guaranteed. People who recovered from COVID-19 before being vaccinated may not need boosters, even if the virus does make a significant transformation. This is Dr. Ali Elbedi, an immunologist who led the study.
Obviously, we cannot look at what's happening in the next few years. But what we can tell is we can look deeply at our immune response at the moment and then try to understand how strong is the immune response being generated at the moment, especially with RNA vaccines. And what we are seeing is that our immune system not only instructing our immune cells to generate a very good immune response, but also is training those cells to perfect their ability to bind to the virus and block the virus. So this is good news, but also it actually inducing those cells to actually become memory cells. And those are the cells we need for future protection. So what we are seeing so far is great news and confirms how, and it's a great indication for how durable the response will be.
Dr. Elbedi and his colleagues reported last month that in people who survived COVID-19, immune cells that recognize the virus lie quiescent in the bone marrow for at least. A study by another team indicated that so-called memory B cells continue to mature and strengthen for at least a year after infection. Based on those findings, researchers suggested that immunity might last for years, possibly a lifetime, in people who were infected with the coronavirus and later vaccinated. But it was unclear whether vaccination alone might have a similarly long-lasting effect. And on Monday, June 28th, California Attorney General Rob Bonta said that California has added an additional 5 states to its list of places where state-funded travel is banned because those states have laws that discriminate against the LGBTQ community. There was initially 12 states where California state employees were barred from traveling except under limited circumstances. The 5 new states are Arkansas, Florida, Montana, North Dakota, and West Virginia. This is California Attorney General Rob Bonta speaking at Monday's press conference.
Adding 5 new states to California's state-funded travel restriction list, bringing the total to 17. The states are a part of a recent dangerous wave of discriminatory new bills signed into law in states all across the country. This new wave of bills directly works to ban transgender youth from playing sports, block access to life-saving care, or otherwise limit the rights of members of the LGBTQ community. Today, as a result of anti-LGBTQ legislation, California is adding the following 5 states to our restrictions list: Arkansas, Florida, Montana, North Dakota, and West Virginia. Of those states, most are being added in part because they are working to prevent transgender women and girls from participating in school sports consistent with their gender identity.
The 12 original states to which travel was banned are Texas, Alabama, Idaho, Iowa, Oklahoma, South Carolina, South Dakota, Kentucky, North Carolina, Kansas, Mississippi, and Tennessee. These were identified in 2016 when California's lawmakers banned non-essential travel to states with laws that discriminate against lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people. And the ban is it bans state employees or those using state funds to travel. The U.S. House of Representatives voted yesterday, Tuesday, June 29th, to remove statues of Confederate officials from the U.S. Capitol, as well as a bust of Chief Justice Roger B. Taney, who wrote the Supreme Court's infamous Dred Scott decision in 1857, which ruled that black people were not entitled to citizenship. The measure to remove the statues passed in the House last year by a vote of 305 to 113, with 72 Republicans voting with Democrats. But the legislation stalled in the Senate, which was then controlled by Republicans. As Democrats now hold the majority in the upper chamber, it will likely be taken up for a vote, but whether enough Republican senators would vote to advance the bill is unclear. Democrats have a 50-seat majority in the Senate, and 60 votes are required to limit debate on a measure. Congressman Jim Clyburn, the House Majority Whip, connected the measure to the attack on the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, during which a rioter carried a Confederate flag into the building. He said, quote, "On January 6th, we experienced the divisiveness of Confederate battle flags being flown inside the U.S. Capitol, yet there are still vestiges that remain in this sacred building that glorify people and a movement that embraced that flag and sought to divide and destroy our great country," unquote. This is South Carolina Congressman and House Majority Whip Jim Clyburn.
"It's a battle flag. We do oppose people who fought to preserve slavery. John C. Calhoun is a statue that's up here, sent up here by the state of South Carolina. John C. Calhoun died more than a decade before the Civil War ever broke out. His statue is not here because of the Confederacy. His statue is here because he's the biggest spokesperson in this country in support of slavery. And that's why my state sent him up here. So I would love to see the state of South Carolina take the statue out of here. But if they don't, then I want to see us put that statue so far in the basement until it will not be able to gather dust."
The bill would revise the statute dictating the types of statues permitted in the Capitol. Under federal law, each state can provide two statues to be placed in the Capitol Statuary Hall, and 11 of these statues depict Confederate officials. Statues removed from Statuary Hall would be returned to their state of origin, and states would be able to replace these statues with ones of other historical figures. Other statues and busts of Confederate officials, which did not originate from a certain state, would also be removed and held in storage by the architect of the Capitol. The bust of Taney would be removed from outside the room where the Supreme Court met from 1810 to 1860, and replaced with a statue of Thurgood Marshall, the first black American Supreme Court justice. Taney's decision in the case of Dred Scott versus Sanford declared that black people, quote, "are not included and were not intended to be included under the word citizen in the Constitution, and can therefore claim none of the rights and privileges which that instrument provides and secures to citizens of the United States," unquote. Taney wasn't entirely wrong. Wasn't wrong at all, in fact. The decision was overturned by the passage of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments a decade later. It's 7:15 a.m. and 82 degrees in Central Park. You're tuned to WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York, and we'll remind everyone that it is awfully hot this morning and later today. We have a heat index value valued as high as 104 degrees today. So there's a heat advisory in effect until 8 p.m. this evening. So everyone who's out there, stay close to the fort, stay off the streets, and take care of yourself. I'm Johanna Fernandez, your host of A New Day. That was Thinking of You by Sister Sledge, and that was a special request from one of our dear listeners and New York teacher, Tanya Kinnickstein Pasco. Public schools are ailing. Many New York City schools have high and chronic absentee rates, and graduation rates in some cases of 50, especially in the city's poorest districts. This according to studies by the Research Alliance for New York City Schools at New York University's Steinhardt School of Culture, Education, and Human Development. The problems are perennial in the New York City public schools, and our schools are in need of radical transformation. So what is to be done? Well, who better to make assessments and recommendations than a dedicated veteran teacher with a long history of radical organizing in this city? One such teacher has outlined a way forward in a recent blog titled, "We Don't Have to Wait for Permission to Create Restorative Model Schools." In this blog, he writes, quote, "Reforms come from the top. Fundamental change comes from below, from the people on the ground. And that's us. If we are to do our part to uproot systemic racism, we need to start with principals and a critical mass of staff, working within our communities across the nation, utilizing all our experiences, and then sharing what our practices have taught us. This will help us establish these model schools in communities throughout the United States." And so, unquote. The author then outlines four areas of work that would be the foundation of deep transformation in the schools. He identifies instruction, assessment of that instruction, essentially how we measure what has been learned. He then outlines change within the realm of safety, how we keep our schools safe. And then he outlines how our schools are structured or should be structured, and how members of the school would interact with each other. And we are joined this morning by the author of this blog, Matthew Golden. Matthew has spent more than 40 years serving New York City's families as a history teacher, an assistant principal, and as dean of students. He's a veteran of all the progressive educational movements which have emerged in New York City since the 1960s. His work began with his involvement in the struggle for community control of schools in the Ocean Hill-Brownsville neighborhood of Brooklyn in 1968. It has continued through his participation in and leadership of the small schools movement of the 1990s and the efforts to establish performance-based assessments as viable and preferable alternatives to standardized testing. His work as dean of students at Eastside Community High School in the early 2000s led him to develop the 100% Respect campaign, a comprehensive cultural change program. He was previously the director of New York's Restorative Justice Pilot Schools Initiative, the initial effort to formally establish restorative justice practices in New York City schools. From 2016 to 2019, he mentored 25 high suspension schools across the city as they embarked on or continued their journey to move from alien communities. He is currently the DOE's lead trainer and coach in restorative justice practices, working with both principals and deans to fundamentally change their school's culture. He has written several how-to pieces on transforming school culture and improving communication between educators and the students and families they serve. Matthew, welcome to A New Day.
Good morning, Johanna. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning. And how are you doing this morning? Are you cool?
Yeah, I'm cool. I mean, I've got air conditioning, so it's okay.
Is A-okay. I'm glad.
Yeah.
I'm glad to hear.
Yeah.
So it's been a minute since we've seen each other, or maybe we saw each other somewhere in passing. I can't remember where.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But didn't we do work together at some point somewhere?
Yeah. The campaign to end the new Jim Crow.
The campaign to end the new Jim Crow out of the Riverside Church.
Absolutely.
Quite a minute ago, and the campaign to prevent our brother from being reincarcerated.
J.F. Hayden.
Jazz Hayden. Yes. mm-hmm. And in fact, one of our producers, Ajamu Sankofa, mm-hmm. was also involved in that effort.
Absolutely. I remember Ajamu, of course.
Yeah. So it's really wonderful to have you back and to read your bio, because sometimes we work with people in our movements, but we really don't know what they do full time.
Right.
We think that they do full time movement work, but in fact, they have full lives.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but it's getting the movement work into your regular work, if at all possible.
Yes, 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 and into your regular life at home mm-hmm. and in the community, absolutely, and workplace. So what can you tell us about your experience as a teacher in the New York public schools before we get into it?
Well, my experience as a teacher, you know, I mean, schools are traditionally set up and traditionally run with all the hierarchies. Look, the main thing is that schools are institutions of the state, just like the police are, the courts are, the hospitals, the healthcare system. And the institutions, like the schools and others, reflect all the prejudices of the society. So there's racism, sexism, ageism, class prejudice, xenophobia, everything. So, you know, you're always having to fight in order to get anything that's really humane. You have to fight for equality in the school, in itself. You have to organize in your school.
You're talking my language, Matthew. That's so simple, or simply said, but so profound, that ultimately mm-hmm. the schools, like the police, are institutions of the state, and they're
right.
going to reflect all the problems of the state under capitalism. But I interrupted you.
Well, the thing is, you have to fight to make things different in your school, and you have to have people organizing in each school. But right now, we really have a chance to, given that, you see, in the past, except when I started in Ocean Hill, Brownsville, in that struggle, that was a whole lot. People understood that it was for community control, for the Black and Puerto Rican community to have control over what went on in the schools, because they felt, rightly so, that the schools were racist. And community control was one attempt to level the playing field. And the school that I was at, IS 55 in Brownsville, was, you know, it was just alive with, you know, the students were into it. We didn't have discipline problems. It was brimming with energy, and a lot of Black staff and Black leadership, and it was wonderful. It was a wonderful place. The experiment got shot down over the the next couple of years for many political reasons. But we have to make our schools be small communities, and we have to change the culture. So rather than the hierarchical way that schools are run, with the principal at the top and the kids at the bottom, really, we have to transform it. And restorative justice is an alternative way to organize things. Go ahead.
So the reason why we're here is because you sent out a blog. I don't ever get emails from you, but you sent out a blog to a number of people you wrote, and I read it very quickly, and it spoke to me immediately. It's so simply written, clearly written, and articulated, and it really gets to the essence and the heart of what change, truly transformative change, could look like. So can you talk to us about the four areas of transformation you outline?
Okay. basically, you have to. So the first thing, like you said, is instruction and assessment. So standardized curriculums, you know, I mean, we've been critical of standardized textbooks because they don't tell the real truth of people. They don't speak to the kids. You have to have you have to have culturally responsive education. What you teach, you know, and this goes into the whole issue of a critical race theory, which is really just teach the real history of the country and make it engaging. Have kids, especially kids in black and brown communities and in Asian communities too, talk about the reality of what's going on in what U.S. history is about. So that's one thing, that to make it not this this whitewashed, if you will, look at history. That's one thing. The second thing is, how do you assess what people learn? It's just standardized testing is like, it only tests a piece of intelligence and reality. When I was working in the small schools movement in the 90s, we had small schools, only a few hundred kids in each school, 15 to 22 in a classroom, so that you really can work with kids. And you didn't have five classes. You had two or three classes of 20 kids. So you can really work with kids. So you can see what their educational needs are and address them. And then performance-based assessment would be a much more comprehensive way to really see what kids know. With performance-based assessment, you are able to really focus in on having the kids do research, write a paper, and present their knowledge. So take questions back and forth, so you really can get to see what they understand, rather than just fill in bubbles or stuff like that.
Hold on. This is fascinating, because a lot of us are not connected to the schools, so we mm-hmm. don't even know these models which have emerged. But this performance-based assessment seems very dynamic. It's also the kind of assessment that would serve students outside of the school. What the hell do you learn by taking a test and filling in a bubble that you can actually use in the world?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit more about performance-based test assessment. What is it exactly?
Well, this is what we did in the small schools. And there are a number of schools, maybe it's up to like 80 or 90 at this point, in what is called the performance-based consortium,
mm-hmm.
Which we started in the 90s. We got a waiver from the state to not take the region. So in these consortium schools, which are expanding even as we talk, if it's up to 90 or 100 now, I mean, there's 1,800 small schools in New York City, so it's a fraction. But in my last 3 years at Vanguard High School,
mm-hmm.
which is a consortium school in the city, I had high school seniors. I taught them how to write a college-level research paper. So we took them to the library at that point in the late 90s, and they did research, and they did redrafted their papers. And then, in order to get the credit for history, instead of a region, they were able to make a presentation to staff members, some students, invite their parents, and then make a presentation based on the paper. People would read it in advance, then ask questions and go back and forth to see if they really understood what was what they had studied and what they were talking about.
Hmm. You're listening to the voice of Matthew Golden, a retired teacher with more than 40 years serving New York City's families as a history teacher. He was also assistant principal and dean of students. He was the director of New York's Restorative Justice Pilot Schools Initiative, the initial effort at formally establishing restorative justice practices in New York City schools. And we're talking about what deep transformation in our schools would look like. I'm Johanna Fernandez, your host of A New Day, and you're listening to WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York. And we're going to take calls a little later on, so stay tuned for that number. So, okay, so you were at assessment. So one area of deep transformation is instruction, what's taught and how we teach it. Mm-hmm. Away with the textbooks and the curriculum that is a whitewashing, as you say, of history and reality. Then the assessment part, how do we measure what folks have learned? Let's get rid of the tests and let's integrate performance-based assessment. What's next? Well, in these four areas?
Right. The third area would be safety, you know, to get police out of schools and replace them with peacekeepers. You know, it's just a different approach. I mean, right now, the Department of Ed, as of a year ago today, the NYPD, as part of the response to, defunding the police, transferred we're in the process of transferring the school safety agents, the 5,000 plus school safety agents, from being a part of the NYPD to being part of the Department of Ed, which they were up until 1998, when the two Rudys, Rudy Crew, made a deal with Giuliani to have the school safety agents go from being under the aegis of the Department of Ed to the NYPD. So it's moving them back. So we're making the transition, and part of that transition will be to retrain the all the school safety agents to be part of the community rather than the, you know, quote, occupying force or someone coming in from the outside and having kids go through metal detectors. Just having them understand restorative practices, working with people, learning how to deal with crises and being trauma-informed, all of that, the trainings that they will go through so that they are part of the community. And what I'm suggesting in the fourth piece is making the whole community make it the village that we always talk about where you want to, you know, create the village. It takes a village to raise a child. Well, let's make our schools the villages. We have a lot of small schools now with just a few hundred kids in it, and that's good, but it's how you run it, how you have people relate to each other, and that's the fourth area, which is what my specialty has been, my focus has been for the last number of years since I was dean at Eastside. It's making communities in your school, and that's what we did in the small schools, and restorative justice, I'm arguing, is a key to doing it. Or restorative justice now, I don't know if people understand, restorative justice basically has two principles. The first principle is to work with anybody who's created some form of harm and have them understand what they did and how it negatively affected other people and help them take responsibility for it. So let's say two kids have a fight or one kid is picking on the other kid. You have to work with them to see the negative impact, and then work together to solve things. So rather than suspend kids, I mean, this is what we started, and that's what the pilot school was about starting in 2015-16, because many schools had already tried to, you know, were working on doing restorative justice because the suspensions in New York were so high around 2008, 9, 10, 11, and so there was like 73,000 suspended every year. So the push was for restorative justice, and organizations like Dig Me and Schools Campaign really took the lead in doing that. And Dig Me and Schools is a coalition of many organizations, student-based organizations, parent organizations, Teachers United is a teacher-based organization that I was in, and Urban Youth Collaborative, and then you have traditional groups like the Children's Defense Fund and Advocates for Children, all pushing the DOE to do restorative justice more comprehensively to get the suspensions down.
Has it worked? Did it work?
Well, yeah, no, the suspensions came down a lot over these over the years in the last decade. But what we're seeing, and this is really part of the reason that I wrote the article, was that we still saw disproportional suspension of African-American kids, kids with, disability, with special ed kids with the IEP, an individualized education plan, and then LGBTQ kids as well. So the disproportionalities stayed. The numbers were less. I mean, only about 35,000 students were suspended, not really looking at last year's statistics because of COVID and all, but the year before. So that's terrific that suspensions are down, but the disproportionality is still there. And so you
what was the original number? What was the original number? What was of suspensions?
That I remember is like 73,000 in 2010, 11, something like that.
Almost.
You know, so, and that's great. But it's like, what is being done instead? There's two issues. I mean, you could just not suspend, which sometimes principals did because the new thing was to, you know, get your suspensions down. So you don't suspend, but do you really help the child?
Right, right.
You know, so
Matthew, we're going to, let's take calls because I know people want to get into this conversation.
Great. Let me just say one more thing. But the main piece in that I'm saying is that you, in order to really uproot the systemic racism and all the other inequities, the ageism, the sexism, the homophobia, the xenophobia, the class prejudice, all of that, you have to not just use restorative justice practices with kids. You have to hold adults accountable, too, because it's not just kids that create harm in schools. If you take that sort of look, then you're criminalizing the kids.
Right.
It's like they're the only ones who create harm. When I do workshops before COVID, when I was doing workshops with principals on how to change your school culture, we talked about who creates harm in schools, and they say, well, everybody. Sometimes you do it, you don't even know. All the adults do it, so all the adults have to be held accountable. So that's what I'm saying is that we have to extend our understanding of restorative justice. It's not just to teach the kids new skills about how to mediate rather than, you know, fight or something like that. Or if you're upset, you know, express your feelings, you know, directly but without cursing someone out or something like that. But you have to hold the adults accountable because adults, you know, create harm all the time because we're human, not because of bad or not because the white teachers are bad, but because people are human. You make mistakes, but it's really what's your approach to life. Is your approach to life giving orders and making people follow what you want to do, or is it working with people? Is it coming from your heart and making that village? Like I'm saying, we have so many small schools, but it's how do you run them? And it's holding the adults accountable in a positive way, not in a gotcha way. That's the hierarchy, gets you and snags you and puts you in jail or writes you up, at work. But it's the whole essence. And since restorative justice, we learn restorative justice from indigenous communities, how they, you know, either, in North American indigenous communities, New Zealand, Maori people, the work has been studied in all African societies as well. It's making that village, like I said before, that's the way to really level the playing field and then be able to, that will lead to dealing with the systemic prejudice in the schools. So if we talk
But also, Matthew, that would provide a model beyond the schools for society. You're listening to the voice of Matthew Golden, a retired teacher with more than 40 years serving New York City's families as a history teacher, as an assistant principal and dean of students. He was the director of New York's Restorative Justice Pilot Schools Initiative, the initial effort at formally establishing restorative justice practices in New York City schools, and we're talking about deep transformation in the schools and how to achieve it. I'm Johanna Fernandez, your host of A New Day, and you're listening to WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York. I'm loving this conversation, and I'd love to bring you in. The number to call is 212-209-2877. 212-209-2877. Call us. Are you a teacher? Do you have children in the schools? What do you think about what our guest is laying out, and how might we accomplish this? This is very exciting, Matthew, because there's a lot of conversation about change in our society, but oftentimes it's abstract. Okay, well, how are we going to do it? And here you outline a way to begin that process of deep transformation now. So we thank you. And if people want to read the article, you can email me at johanna@wbai.org, and I can send it to you. You can email me at Johanna, J-O-H-A-N-N-A, at WBAI.org. I'm sure we're going to get some callers soon. But I interrupted you, Matthew. So what were you going to say?
Well, so, I mean, that's the basic point of that article that appeared in Education Post, an online publication. To say,
you know,
that,
what? Wait, hold on, Matthew. We've got two callers. So okay. I want to take the caller so that then I can give it to you. And you know what? We're going to have to bring you back. This is an incredible conversation. Caller, you're on the line. Tell us your name and where you're calling from.
From Brooklyn, my name is Denise.
Denise.
First, can you give us the name of the blog that you mentioned? That's the first thing. And then the second thing is, what do you think about this woke program that they're trying to implement in schools, where they teach young children about the actual history of what transpired during the development of our country? It seems to be kind of being used to manipulate and to depreciate relationships between people. I'd like to know what your thoughts are on it. I think it's called the 1819 or 1619 program.
1619, yeah.
Okay, wait, Matthew, let me take another call. Let me take another call, and then I'll give it back to you. Caller, you're on the line. Tell us your name and where you're calling from.
Hello.
Yes.
My name is Joe. Can you hear me?
Yes, Joe. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'll just say what's not being taught in the schools. Most of human history, people lived in collective egalitarian societies where everyone was needed and everyone was cared for. Only in the last 10,000 years were people used as slaves, commodities, exploiters, and killers in capitalist societies. The U.S. Constitution's purpose was to forever deny any chance of working class power, and racism was invented to divide the working class. The Tulsa Massacre was part of a worldwide attack on revolutionary workers throughout the 20s and 30s. Working people need to organize with communists to destroy capitalism and the profit system and create an egalitarian system free of racism, sexism, and war. Thank you for letting me speak.
Thank you, Joe. Okay, Matthew, it's you.
Yeah, so yes to, you know, what Joe's saying, and it's like, it's rebuild that collective consciousness. That's what I was talking about, you know, using restorative justice as a way to, you know, restorative justice, you do things in circle. Everyone gets a chance to speak. Everyone is heard. You listen with an open mind and an open heart. You speak from your heart. You don't put other people down, and you collectively work stuff out. And that's what the indigenous life was like, more centered like that, rather than the hierarchy that we have. So it's pushing that sort of ethic. And the curriculum, the 1619 curriculum, is basically, as far as I know it, I mean, I haven't taught it, so I haven't, like, really seen it up, but I've certainly read stuff about it and heard stuff about it. It seems to be, it's like telling the real history of the country. It's not made-up stuff. What a lot in the in traditional curricula, there's a lot of, you know, stuff that's left out, and, you know, slavery and the stealing of the land from indigenous tribes here in North America and South America. So, you know, but anything that is used is misused to make people feel bad about themselves. White people are, you know, as good as anybody else. You know, and everyone gets brainwashed by the society, because not just how our it's not just that our institutions reflect the prejudice of the society. We get taught them as we grow up in our families, in the school, in the street, or you know, on
the TV. Socialized.
We're socialized into prejudices. So if white people have crazy, you know, negative thoughts about people of color, well, okay, they were taught that. Rather than make people feel guilty, if you want to work with people and in the schools, if you want to work with, you know, white teachers, no need to guilt anybody, but it's got to be real. And that's what you have, and now you have like these consciousness-raising groups, you know, to understand that people get, you know, taught all sorts of garbage about themselves and about each other. So we really had that's part of what the community does.
Matthew,
work with people.
I wish you had been my teacher. We've got another call. Caller, you're on the line. Tell us your name and where you're calling from.
My name is Sandra. I'm calling from Manhattan.
Hi.
I love this concept of restorative justice. It hit me like a lightning bolt when I just heard it, because it's healing. It's nurturing.
Right.
It's like putting an arm around someone and correcting them. It's such a wonderful concept rather than punitive justice. This restorative justice is just a wonderful concept, and we all can, you know, we all should take advantage of it and employ that concept in every walk of life. It's so beautiful. I love it. Thank you so much for it.
Thank you. Matthew.
Yeah. So, yes, Sandra, that absolutely. I mean, we should organize our, you know, our society would be better. The more people that, the more institutions that take this approach, it's a whole way of life. You know, are you working with people or are you, you know, working in competition with them? But, you know, capitalism is built on competition. So everyone learns to be competitive and individualistic as opposed to collective and cooperative. So, yeah, so this is what we're talking about, transforming society. If we're going to treat people, if we're going to undo the prejudice and the horrors of the past, you know, we have to change how our institutions run, because our institutions are embedded with all the prejudices of the past. And restorative justice is a way. I mean, the thing is, I argue that the way that you do this is you hold the adults accountable in schools, and you also embed restorative justice practices and theory into the daily life of the school. So you run your department meetings or your grade meetings for the staff. You run them in circle. You know, let everyone speak, not the assistant principals are giving the directives for the, you know, what the math department should do or what the seventh grade should do or something like that. Have everyone discuss the issues.
Matthew,
yeah.
We're going to take you down memory lane right now to the Brownsville struggle. Let's play that clip.
Most people use the word decentralization. You can decentralize and don't change anything. We're talking about change. I mean change of the education for our children and our communities. So far, there are the main ones that we really wanted and we were asking for are in the areas of personnel, physical control. We're talking about the same kinds of controls that the Board of Education has that we feel can be designated to the community so that they can then make educational achievement for their children.
We here in Ocean Hill, Brownsville are more desperate for some of these powers than the other two groups. As you know, we have selected 7 new principals. But even with the best principals in the world, education will never improve while some assistant principals and some teachers refuse to cooperate.
We only want to control our schools and our area. We want to get the opportunity for our children to learn the same way the other children in other areas learn. And our main concern is for the legislature to support our guidelines. All we want is better education for the children. We don't want black power. We don't want any of the things that they claim. If the legislature or any of them would come down and see the schools that our children go to school in, they wouldn't be so interested in what type of power we wanted. They would see that our children are under conditions that it doesn't even seem that could be possible.
Matthew, we've got a nanosecond, literally. Your thoughts as we conclude the show.
Well, for that clip on Ocean Hill, I mean, that's what it was about, community control. You know, having local school board rather than back in the day, you had the Board of Ed ran everything. There were no separate school districts. So this is what the people in Ocean Hill Brownsville were fighting for, the black and Puerto Rican community, to be able to control curriculum and hiring and stuff like that. But we could do a whole other show on that, that's for sure.
Absolutely, and we're going to bring you back. We thank you so very much for your clarity and your passion, your low-key passion and clarity and love for the communities where you work. Thank you so very much for your 40 years of service to New York City.
Thank you, Johanna Fernandez, for all of your work, and congratulations on the award for your Young Lords book.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. So we're going to bring you back so we can talk about that subject, the 60s.
All right. Great.
You've been listening to the voice of Matthew Golden, a retired teacher with more than 40 years serving New York City's families as a history teacher, assistant principal, and dean of students. He's a veteran of the progressive educational movements coming out of New York City since the 1960s. He was the director of New York's Restorative Justice Pilot Schools Initiative, the initial effort at formally establishing restorative justice practices in New York City schools. He's currently a consultant for the DOE and lead trainer and coach in the restorative justice practices. You've been listening to Non-Commercial, listener-funded community radio, WBAI, at 99.5 FM in New York. It's 7:58 and 82 degrees in Central Park this morning, Wednesday, June 30th, 2021. We're rebuilding the world together and ushering in a new day. This show was produced by Ajamo Sankofa, Ellis Maxwell, and Marcos Maldonado Cruz. Michael G. Haskins is our engineer. We leave you with Lost Ones by Lauryn Hill. I'm your host, Johanna Fernandez. See you on Friday.
It's funny how money changes situation. Miscommunication leads to complication. My emancipation don't fit your equation. I was on the humble, you on every station. Someone play young Lauryn like she done. But remember not to game the one under the sun. Everything you did has already been done. I know all the tricks from bricks to Kingston. My ting done, major kingdom, one run. Boogie, not violent. But if a thing tests me, run for me gun. Can't take a threat to me newborn son. L been this way since creation. A groupie call you far from temptation. Now you on ball over separation. Tarnish my image in the conversation. Who you gonna scrimmage like you the champion? You might win some, but you just lost one. You might win some, but you just lost one. You might win some, but you just lost one. You might win some, but you just lost one.
Listener-sponsored, commercial-free, Radio WBAI, A New Day with Johanna Fernandez back on Friday. Thank you all so much for tuning in. Please remember that this is a commercial.